The Business on RT Radio 1 with Ulster Bank. For when you're keen to know what Brexit means for your business, visit ulsterbank.ie/Brexit.
Well, whether the leaving certificate would go ahead has been a source of stress and anxiety for many young people around the country since the lockdown began. 2 years ago, our next guest was one of those students. Now he's building his company, Evervault, with big name investors on board. Their hopes are that it will become a billion-dollar business. We caught up with Shane Curran earlier. I first asked him if the proposed government solution for the leaving cert, would that have suited you?
Probably wouldn't have been amazing for a student like me who kind of tended to pull the results out of the bag at the last minute without a massive amount of upfront preparation. But yeah, no, at least a solution was reached.
When you look back at your own leaving cert experience as well in the latter days of secondary school, you sort of did it the hard way, Shane, because I read that you were off in San Francisco looking at various business options and investment options for ideas that you had just days before your English exam. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, I never really did things the easy way. I think I definitely kind of put myself up to a challenge there at that one. So yeah, at the time I was kind of fundraising for Evervault and just kind of meeting a few people initially around Europe. And then I kind of just realized that I kind of wanted to follow this long-term dream to visit Silicon Valley and, you know, potentially move over there. So yeah, just basically the week before my leaving cert, I decided to hop on a plane because I got a lot of meetings lined up with you know, some very big investors and other founders from other tech companies as well. So hopped over in a plane, had a week full of meetings, and then flew back for English paper one with about sort of 12 or 14 hours to go. So I was kind of jacked up on coffee and all that sort of stuff. So it was a pretty rough 2 weeks with the exams, but yeah, got there in the end.
You still did well in English.
Yeah, no, I'm pretty glad with how I did. Yeah, I think English was my best exam. And then as the weeks went on, it was sort of a general downhill trajectory. But I think the coffee helped.
You were interested in technology from a very, very early age. Was that something that your parents encouraged? I mean, what age were you when you got your first computer?
I was very young. I think I was probably 6 or 7 when I first started learning about computers and kind of messing around on the internet. It's actually a very good parenting technique. Actually, I recommend giving a computer that barely works to a kid, because then they have to figure out how to make it work, put it back together, take it apart. And it kind of teaches you the fundamentals, as opposed to, you know, giving someone, you know, giving a kid an amazing computer that's just perfect and works the whole time.
I mean, most kids would probably just throw it out if their parents handed them that.
I mean, I was close to it a few times, definitely. Yeah, I mean, I wasted so many, well, I wouldn't say wasted, but I spent so many days and weeks just trying to get the things working. But I think, you know, if you play this thing long term, it's always the best way to look at it. So, you know, I'm glad that I had lots of stuff that didn't work at the time.
And you actually had your own startup business at age 11, which is kind of incredible, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I think it was just a problem that had to be solved. Like, I think in general, the biggest thing that people, particularly technologists, have is that they do a lot of research and they do a lot of kind of technical work. But actually applying it to a real world problem is a sort of a different level of complexity that a lot of people don't think about. And I think it's, you know, sometimes it's pretty sad to see some great work kind of just end up in a paper or something that never actually gets implemented and kind of, you know, applied to a real world problem. So when I built a system for libraries back about 10 years ago, you know, I just wanted people to use it. So the easiest way to distribute this software that I'd written to the masses was to basically put it on the internet and see what happened. And yeah, it went pretty well and kind of kept me in comic books at the time. But yeah, it kind of led one thing onto another.
How did it work, Shane?
It was basically a system for librarians, or, you know, particularly in a school environment where you mightn't have a full-time librarian. Teachers would have to go around and type in all the books' information manually. They'd spend, you know, weeks and weeks putting together a catalogue of a typical school library. So what I did was basically put together an app that used the camera on the phone to scan the barcode in the back, then pulled in all the books' information automatically. So when a student came to take out a book, or if someone in a library came to take out a book, you could just scan the barcode again and do it in a couple of seconds. So, you know, you could catalogue an entire library in 2 hours as opposed to 2 weeks.
Did you make any money out of it, or was the business element of it just a sort of an afterthought? It was really about trying to find a solution to a library software problem.
Yeah, it was definitely about solving a problem, but you know, I did learn a few fundamental business lessons doing that. I think, like, one of the things especially is because it was this sort of continual service that I was providing. I charged like a $9 lifetime membership for the whole thing. And that kind of came back to bite me a bit later on, because the running cost of software, as more people use it, gets, you know, exponentially more expensive. So I had to shut it down eventually because too many people wanted to use it and too few people had paid to actually keep the thing sustainable. So that was a fundamental business lesson I learned that, you know, still stands true today. But yeah, it was really about solving the problem and getting people, you know, saving people time and kind of improving their lives. That was the biggest driver for me.
Now, you obviously got a lot of publicity when you won the Young Scientist of the Year. Did that bring about a lot of pressures in its own way as well? There's a sort of an expectation about what you're going to do if you're a really smart person who wins that.
I think, yeah, like there's always a challenge with that. Like for me, I tend not to get caught up in kind of external perspectives on what I'm working on and what, you know, we as a company are working on. So, you know, obviously expectations are there, but I think that's a good thing. But yeah, we don't get too caught up in, you know, in vanity metrics and prizes and all this sort of stuff. Libramatic, the library system, was the first thing that I'd entered, but I built a lot of other things in the meantime that I wanted to share with other people. So yeah, when I entered my final project when I was in fifth year in school, that was my fourth time entering.
So you were pretty determined that that was something you had in your sights that you really wanted to win.
It was never about victory, I think. I genuinely just really enjoyed the whole thing. They have discos and stuff afterwards, which were great, especially as a 15 or 16 year old. It was really, really fun to meet other people your own age. Although people might think it's quite nerdy, but the reality is it's not.
Yeah, does a lot untoward go on at a Young Scientist of the Year disco?
I can't comment on that without lawyers in the room.
Most people would have felt that for someone interested in computers at an early age, has lots of ideas, that going on to study computer science in university would be the next phase. But you had a very different university experience. You went to UCD for 3 days.
Yeah, I tend to be pretty pragmatic with things. So, you know, it was probably at the time I felt like I could do enough with software that maybe a degree in computer science wouldn't have been the most useful thing that I could do. But because I was kind of so caught up in, you know, in the cycle of building product and building the team at Evervault at the time, you know, when it came around to kind of starting college, I just didn't really think about it very much. I kind of just went because all my friends were there and it looked kind of fun and Freshers Week and stuff like that, which it was. And it's, you know, it's something I at least at the time felt like I was missing out on. Although these days, I mean, I don't feel too bad because everyone's kind of, again, sitting at home in front of a Zoom class. So there's no real social element to it anymore. went for 3 days, but then kind of just decided that things were, you know, a lot more promising with what I was working on with Evervault. But it wasn't a surprise to anyone when I dropped out.
Why did you leave after 3 days? What was it about the first couple of days that sort of crystallized that and you said, no, this is not for me?
I think in general, it's just fundamental misalignment with how universities teach business. I think like it's always very good to put frameworks and processes around business in general, but I remember sitting inside a, you know, an introduction to business lecture, and the first slide was the lecturer asking, you know, why do people start businesses? And the traditional answer, and I think the answer that the lecturer was expecting, is, you know, to make a profit or, you know, to generate revenues or something like this. But and you know, when he clicked the slide or moved to the next slide, the thing on the screen was just a big clip art money bag. And for me, that was just very different to the way I see building companies and starting businesses, is that it's not totally around you know, generating short-term profits and this kind of thing. It's more around just long-term solving a problem and, you know, building a lot of value for the people that use the product. That philosophical misalignment was just kind of the final nail in the coffin, but it was just kind of that. And then I was just way too busy. I was probably very close to burnout if I had stayed in college for much longer. So I had to make a choice one way or the other.
Now, Evervault is the business. What does it do?
Data privacy is a really big problem right now. There's more people connected to the internet than ever before. There's 4.5 billion people, and they all need data privacy. But so far, you look at things like Facebook with the Cambridge Analytica scandal, or all of these other famous data breaches like Yahoo, and you know, recent examples with smaller companies like Roblox or whatever. So it's a really big problem. But all of the approaches have been around solving it with regulation. Which I think is just totally the wrong way to solve it. So you can't really solve a problem with regulation. You can kind of hinder the growth of a problem, but you can't actually solve it properly. So we think that instead of regulation, the best way to solve data privacy is through technology. What that means is we're basically building tools for people who are building software, whether it's an app or a website. We give them a couple of lines of code that they can put in, and then we look after all their data privacy for them, so that we can give data privacy to, you know, hopefully all 4.5 billion people on the internet in a really easy way.
A very important part of many tech startups is getting to California, getting to Silicon Valley to find investors and supporters for the business. I mean, that was something that you were doing with EverVault while you were still in school. How did you start? Where did you begin?
It wasn't an instant thing. You know, I'd gone over a couple of times to meet with a few people over there, kind of initially the Irish mafia who were, founders and investors over there. Met with them and, you know, before long, I think maybe it's the Irish charm or maybe it's just sort of, genuine interest in EverVault, but... you know, over time, they just introduce you to their friends. And before long, you're kind of in meetings with these legendary investors and these sort of, you know, well-known established companies that everyone kind of hears about and knows about on a daily basis. But I'd gone over a few times before, you know, finally met with investors like Sequoia and Kleiner Perkins, who ended up investing in our seed round 9 months ago.
When you then met potential investors, you've got to sell the idea, sell what it is you want to do. You've got to sell yourself as well, because they've got to decide whether they're going to back you. Given that you were so young, was that an obstacle? Was that something you were self-conscious about? Did you feel that that's an issue for them? They might even be patronizing me.
You know, it's always something at the back of your mind, but I think at the time I'd been, you know, I was so used to just kind of presenting what I was working on and, you know, my vision for the future, I guess. And it was just sort of second nature to me at that stage. But, you know, the reality is when you're kind of meeting people who are real investors, you know, they're not going to make a sympathy investment. It's very much about a real market opportunity and a real problem. So, you know, you kind of break through that barrier very early on when you're kind of building a company like this. But, you know, I think the investment with these investors was pretty much that, you know, data privacy was a very big problem and they believed in us as a team to be able to execute on that problem and solve it.
One of the investors you have on board is Sequoia Capital. They have backed some of the biggest Silicon Valley companies, haven't they?
They've invested in companies like Apple, Google, Airbnb, so, you know, the names we all know. And, you know, they've been a great partner to work with over time. So looking forward to continuing that in the future.
There has been a sort of cult of the tech billionaire, whether it's the Elon Musks or Mark Zuckerberg or Jeff Bezos. What do you make of all that? Do you think that maybe some of these guys are applauded, lionized too much, criticized too much?
I mean, I won't comment on any particular cases, but I think in general, it's, you know, these people have obviously a lot of wealth, but at the same time, it's not always entirely liquid. I mean, it's always a byproduct of the value that they're creating and the problems that they're solving. I mean, I said it wouldn't mention cases, but you look at someone like Elon Musk, you know, he's solving really major problems. And although he's gotten involved in some scandal recently with, you know, going back to work a little bit earlier than people would like and all this kind of thing, you know, he's really solving problems and, you know, running a number of kind of massively successful companies that are solving problems that other people aren't working on. So, I think people who get caught up in the figures and, you know, the idea of being a billionaire or something like that are probably the kind of people who aren't suited to be one. You know, the people who are, you know, I say the best billionaires are the ones that, you know, don't even realize that they are.
When you look at your own ambitions, you once said that a nightmare scenario for you would be to end up selling EverVault for $50 or $100 million. What's nightmarish about that?
I mean, as always, like I don't tend to get caught up in the financial situation of it in general. I think, you know, it's always, you know, a useful metric to kind of look at to see how close you are to solving the problem. But, you know, I believe the problem of data privacy is firstly growing, but secondly, it's far bigger than that. So we hope to be the company that solves data privacy.
Now, when it comes to EverVault, you have around 8 staff at the moment. Obviously, you have plans to grow that. Where is the business at now? Are you still developing a product that you hope to bring to market? Are you bringing a product to market in a small way?
We're intentionally very low scale right now. We're really laser targeting individual companies in industries where data in general is just highly valued. So that's things like med tech, kid tech, fintech, all these kind of industries where, you know, the risk of data going missing or data being capitalized on is extremely high. So we're deliberately kind of being very low profile around that, but you know, it's very promising, and, you know, we plan on kind of rolling that out in a very calculated and sort of progressive way. But it's going very well. We don't really see headcount or sort of the size of the team as an important metric to measure, and there's probably an inverse correlation between, you know, the size of a team and the probability of success. So we're really just focused on building an amazing product that no one else has been able to build.
So do you plan on staying in Dublin, Shane, for a long time to come? Or do you think it's inevitable that when the business reaches a certain size, and that may be soon enough, you need to move to California or somewhere like that?
I think so. I think there's some companies that have done this really well and executed really well on it when it comes to kind of building a distributed team. So I think our product is going to remain in Dublin for the foreseeable future. We are looking at other places. You know, there's a lot of talent in places like London, and I guess fortunately for us, but unfortunately in general, it's an interesting time with big companies laying off exceptionally talented people. So we're very lucky to be in the fortunate position where we can kind of bring them on board and get them on the team. But I think realistically our sales and marketing and go-to-market will be mostly done out of the Bay Area, but we're going to keep product in Dublin and kind of keep the heart of what we're working on in Ireland.
Well, Shane Curran, founder of Evervault, thank you very much for joining us on the program.
Thanks, Richard.